My name is Blanche, and I'm a grateful, recovering Al-Anon high. And I have been a member of the Al-Anon family group since July 7th, 1964. And 23 years makes me a survivor, not a savior. I love it when I'm asked to share all the steps. I can give you my experience and my beliefs and my observations. They may not be the same as yours. But I think in talking about the steps, that the point I want to make most strongly, it breaks my heart when I see people coming to the program and settle for a spiritual band-aid. I have always been greedy for it, and I still am, and I'm attracted to people who are greedy for it. I have no criticism of them, those who want less, but I think they are settling for crumbs, you know, when a banquet is spread. I think that there is no recovery, not in my experience or observation, without meetings and without the steps. This is why they're the first two requirements I make of anyone whom I'm going to sponsor. The only validity I have is telling you what has worked for me. And this is a sharing and not a lecturing. This is telling you where I'm coming from. I was given an overall view of the steps early on, and I haven't found any way to improve on that. It still helps me to see them in their entirety. The first three were taught me as surrender steps. I had trouble thinking that we won by surrender. I thought we won by fighting. And as I mentioned earlier, I still have a problem with surrendering sometimes. It's not what I do most easily or most naturally. I was told to take these before my feet hit the floor in the morning. And I do. It may be the only thing in Al-Anon that I do perfectly, but I do that. And then I was told that steps 4 through 9 would clear away the wreckage of the past, and I was indignant, and I informed everyone that there was no wreckage in my past, that they could ask anybody. I think now how wise they were. Instead of talking to me about the many different kinds of wreckage, my group and my sponsors said, all right, steps 4 through 9 will heal your memories. Can you buy that? And I could buy that. I really needed the memories healed. And they said that the last three were maintenance steps. And it seems to me in any program of change, maintaining the new way of life is harder than achieving it. The excitement of starting something new is gone, and the drama and the attention that we're getting is gone, and we start the steady day-by-day plugging away. I have always felt, of course, over-responsible. That's a characteristic of most of us who end up in Al-Anon. And anytime I had to miss school, I gave these long, detailed explanations, far more than anyone was interested in knowing, as to why I was not going to be there. And I can remember telling some classes at one time, I have an arthritic knee and I was going to get it treated, and I was explaining that I did not leave them lightly, you know, but I had a good reason. And one of the boys said with the utmost compassion, once you pass 40, it's just a matter of maintenance, isn't it? Once you pass 50, it certainly is a matter of maintenance. So I'm glad that we have steps to help us to maintain. Everywhere I have lived in the program, and that's been two cities, there are active, vigorous step study meetings. I recommend them. This is where I was able to hear from other people, here's what worked for me. You know, many of us grew up in dysfunctional homes and we didn't have a blueprint for normal. And when I go to meetings, I don't get a blueprint, but I do get to learn what works. And I especially needed to hear what worked where the steps were concerned. The ideas in these are not new. Neither of our fellowships claims to have a monopoly on the truth. And the steps came about through the teachings of a number of people, including a number of the scriptures. They appealed to me at first because I knew they were psychologically sound and not just some weird crackpot scheme, which always makes me leery. But the principles appear in all spiritual writings that I have read. Al-Anon is not just a support group, you know. We do have a plan for a recovery. I think it's important that we get some help individually on the steps too, as well as going to step meetings and read what the literature has to say about them. And one of the roles of the sponsor is to take our hand and lead us through the 12 steps. I was told on those first three, you know, to take them before I got out of bed in the morning. That's because I don't wake up very alert. I have quit apologizing for that. You can be a good person and not wake up very alert. I don't wake up grouchy, I wake up slowly. And that is not when I have my 11th step time. My sponsor, knowing that, suggested I at least get the first three steps done. Now, I have traveled with Al-Anons who woke up not only bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, but spiritual. And I don't believe in God till 10 o'clock, and I don't think anything worthwhile ever happened before noon. But I do those three, and sometimes I use the short version, which our teens use. You know, I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. And no matter how foggy you are in the morning, I believe you can say that. The step that we begin with says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Those of us who lived with alcoholics, I believe, thought that we had tremendous power because we thought we could stop this person from drinking or that we could cause it. And that is assuming a great deal of power. And one reason those of us who end up in Al-Anon are so good at it, taking on inappropriate guilt, is because we would rather feel guilty than powerless. Does that make sense? I would rather have felt guilty because I made my husband get drunk than to accept the fact that I was powerless over his drinking. And so, of course, I've continued that into lots of other areas. There were years when I felt guilty about earthquakes in Peru, the assassination of public figures, the weather. It's as if I had a daily quota of guilt to fill. So I have to admit my powerlessness, and that relieves a great deal of inappropriate guilt. I think we get here a combination of dictator and doormat. But I was certainly accustomed to managing, and it was hard for me to think of my life as being unmanageable. Here again, I had to have things explained to me. The powerless does not mean helpless. Now see, that's how I heard it. My sponsor said, all you're doing in steps 1 and 2 is changing your source of power. And when you admit in number 1 that you don't have it, then in number 2, you accept the fact that there is a power that does. And so we are not helpless. We are not without power. We are just not the source of it. And we are not, thank God, powerless to help people. And I'm sorry to say, we're not powerless to hurt them, but we are powerless to change them. I've decided there's no such thing as constructive criticism. It never constructed anything at my house. I don't like it. I don't know anyone who does. I can hear the truth in love from someone who cares about me and who is approaching it with the idea of, I don't think what you're doing is in your best interest. I can hear that. But people who are out to change us don't have much luck. I'm sure they have no more with you than they do with me. I think criticism is like shining a bright light in someone's face and then he can't see anything at all. And when I am miserable, it's because I have forgotten step 1. And I am mentally trying to change someone else. I am thinking, well, why doesn't he? Or I wish he would. And that's forgetting my powerlessness over other people. If we have any trouble, they told me, with a step, we haven't worked the one preceding it thoroughly enough. And I was taught that they are in order and or to be taken in order, and I haven't found any reason to change that in all this time. Step two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I was taught this, as I'm sure you were, one word at a time, that we came. And for me, that was the biggest hurdle. I was extremely reluctant and angry. I didn't think I needed any help. I had coped very well. I hadn't done the drinking. I certainly didn't need the therapy. I also didn't like your taking away my whipping boy and my scapegoat, because if you live with an alcoholic, anything that goes wrong can be blamed on the problem, you know, with a capital P. And we get to Ural, and no one was thinking I was saintly and wonderful. They were encouraging him, you know. They were saying, 30 days, Charlie, great, way to go. You know, 90 days, hang in there. And they not only didn't think I was great, but they were hinting rather broadly that I could use some help. And no one had ever done that to me in my life. And so I had quite a bit of reluctance. Besides, I wanted to be the one to get him sober. Then you see, he would have loved it all, owed it all to the love of a good woman. And he would have been grateful to me the rest of his life. And you may be sure I would have seen to it that he was. And God did not then nor now use me where I tell him to, but where he sees fit to do so. And so I had quite a few hurdles of my own in coming in the first place. And then we come to. And it was for me very much like having been spiritually unconscious. Now, I had been very religious. And I have to be careful here, because I know some people can be both. And some can be one and some can be the other. But I had been religious. And it was like waking up, becoming alive and alert spiritually. It was also painful coming to. It was like having I was so emotionally frozen. And you know, when anything that's been frozen falls out, there is a great deal of pain. And for a long time, when I hurt somewhere, it was a little pocket that was still frozen that was finally beginning to thaw. The word sanity gave me a very hard time. As I said this morning, alcoholism was not trendy back then, and it wasn't the end thing, and it wasn't talked about publicly, and there were not celebrities going into recovery, and it wasn't widely accepted that the entire family was ill. And I thought, this implied that someone should come drop a net over me, and men in white coats, you know, should take me away. But I do know something about words. And I know that the word sanity comes from the Latin sanus, which means clean or whole. And here again, my sponsor said, can you accept that you have been fragmented and that you need to be made whole again? And I had no problem with that. Of course, today I have no problem with the word sanity. And then we come to believe in God, of course, but also in ourselves and in each other. And there's a fine point here that I didn't get for a number of years. A wonderful Al-Anon friend in Kansas taught me that this is the trust step. And I said, oh, I have no trouble believing in God. And she said, that's not what I said. There's a difference in belief and trust. The best analogy I know, and without using names, is that I can believe that someone holds a political office, that he exists, that he has tremendous power. That doesn't mean I trust him. Okay? I've never had any trouble believing in God. I have ongoing trouble with trust. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, I was accustomed to making decisions. This one I thought would be a breeze. That was a real decision maker. I made him for me and for everyone else. And then I hit the snag, because turning my life over was all right. This implied gaining guidance and protection. But turning my will over was something else. I learned from my then husband's sponsor, from whom I learned so much. I heard him telling her, that he was afraid to turn his life and his will over to God because God would make him be a missionary in Africa. And she said, "Well, Charles, if he does, he'll give you the desire to go." And I was like one of those cartoon characters when the light bulb goes on, you know? Because I believe with all my heart that God guides me by giving me the desire to do it, and I pay close attention to that. There's a difference now between wanting to and liking to. I pay attention to what I want, not always to what I like. I guess about midway in our marriage, Charles decided he'd like to learn to fly, and he did, and we had a Cessna 184 Skyhawk. I wanted to fly with him. I didn't like it, but I wanted to do it. Okay? A little more recently, when I was writing my master's thesis, I did not like doing it because I don't know how to write scientifically, and they kept putting in the margin nasty comments such as, "much too literary, too emotional." I finally said to my advisor, "You're lucky I didn't do the whole thing in poetry form." I didn't like doing it, but I wanted to. And so I pay attention to what I want, because I do believe that when God has an assignment for me, he will give me the desire to do it. He will also not ask anything that I don't have the ability to do. And it's my personal belief that he gives me the time and the energy. And if I don't have all four of those, then it's something I've taken on myself. It helps me in turning my life over to him, to know that what he wants for me is better than anything I could possibly imagine for myself. I also had to learn that I wanted his will more than I wanted anything else, and that requires some trust. It's sort of like a relinquishing, a taking hands off. I have had to be willing in my life to give up at one time or another everything and everybody in it. I haven't been required to give up everybody in it, but I've been required to be willing. Sort of like Abraham and Isaac, you know, in the scripture. And that willingness comes a little more easily all the time. And if it does turn out that I have to give it up, like a marriage, then I feel as keenly guided there as in any other area. Now, a total surrender is not knuckling under. It is not saying a reluctant, "Oh, all right." It is joyous acceptance of God's will. My tendency is to approach him with, "Let me know your will for me, God, and I'll give it my serious consideration." And that isn't surrender, and that one won't work. I like very much the fact that in this fellowship we are allowed God as we understand him, not strained and filtered through any denomination or any kind of ministry or book. And I have understood him better year by year, but more important, I know that he understands me. And God as I understand him is totally different today from God as I understood him when I got to you. And I don't remember a time in my life when I did not pray and when I did not believe I was leading a God-centered life. I hope that in another 23 years, God, as I understand him, will be different too. I'm counting on it. After I had done the best surrendering I could with these first three, and I still do them every morning, I had been in the program long enough to have done a fourth step before, but I had put it off because I thought that self-knowledge would lead to self-hatred. And my self-esteem was none too good as it was. And it took a lot of people saying to me, "No, self-knowledge leads to self-acceptance." That I finally got the courage to start the inventory. The step says, "Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves." You know, this is not life or death for Al-Anons. We won't get drunk if we don't take it. And so we can stay sick a lot longer. And I did. Sometimes we have gained a little bit of relief and we think that further insight will be so painful that we settle for just an immediate easing of the pain. It's a matter of a little knowledge, you know, being a dangerous thing. But I see it happen, and I'm grateful that no one permitted me to stop with just a little. Self-knowledge, then, is not self-condemnation. And it is not shattering. We just won't see more than we can handle. I told you that I had done a lot of reading on mental health and mental illness because I didn't suspect alcoholism. I thought my husband was crazy. I really did. And I thought I'd better learn all I could about it. My answer to any problem is to read a book on it, 4 or 5, maybe. Talk about it, think about it, and pray about it. But as Lindy said so well this morning, change comes through action. And I can do all those things and no change takes place at all. But I did know that in psychoanalysis, if a patient doesn't see something that the psychoanalyst sees, the psychoanalyst waits. He doesn't point it out, he waits until the patient can see it for himself. And our policy digest allows us to make brief references to other literature. So in about 2 sentences, is that brief enough? In Karen Harney's book, Psychoanalysis, Self-Analysis, she says that you have built-in blind spots and you won't see something that you can't cope with. And then I got to you and you said, go ahead and do this step. God won't show you more than you can handle. And he never has. I have gained the insights as I have been able to cope with them and handle them. I like the word fearless in here because I think it requires a lot of emotional courage. I think this whole program is not for the emotional cowards of the world. It's heady stuff. And I think it's not surprising, maybe, that some people find that they can do the first 3 steps and they get stuck. And a searching inventory implies that we dig. We didn't have our 12 and 12 book back then. And when it was being written, a lot of us were allowed to have some input into it. And I am grateful that our Al-Anon literature permits us any number of ways, 4 or 5 at least, of doing an inventory. One of the ways permitted in our book is a life story. That's the one I had been brought up on in Al-Anon, and so I like that one. It's the one that was used on me. So it's the one I use when I sponsor people. They suggested that I divide my life roughly into 7-year periods and write down what happened and how I felt about it. You know, not just that my little brother was born, but how did I feel? And I did. And the feelings come back. I type mine because I type so much faster than I write, and I would get angry all over again, and my hands would shake, and I had to quit typing. That's my test, by the way, of identifying a resentment today, and it has been for years. The S-E-N-T in resent comes from the Latin word for feeling. You know, we get sentiment from the same root. And if we resent, we re-feel. When I can remember something without anger, there's no resentment there. But if on remembering it, I get mad all over again, that's the red flag on the field. And I know that's a resentment, and I hit a number of them while I was doing the life story. I think this is particularly advantageous for Al-Anon because I think, at least in my case, okay, I felt that every defect I had come about as a result of living with an alcoholic. And I found by looking over my whole life that I had come into my marriage with every defect of character I possessed, that they would have caused me trouble in any marriage and would certainly have made me sick. And I needed to see that. I also needed to see patterns of behavior. We can't fix what we can't see. We can't even turn over to God what we can't see. I'll give you an example. I had pride on my list of defects, and when I was later doing my 5th step with Marcy W., she said, How do you think that one came about? And I said, well, you know, if you live with an alcoholic, you have to have some pride. You can't survive. And she pointed out that in telling her my life story, I had mentioned that in the 2nd grade, a very sensitive and caring teacher had recommended that I get a free lunch. That's because there wasn't anything to eat at my house, and we went days on end, literally, with no food. And for 2 weeks, I struggled between hunger and pride. I couldn't swallow it, you know, for the tightness in my throat. There's a line in Grapes of Wrath that says, if a body's ever took charity, it makes a burn that don't come out. Hunger won, by the way, and it will every time. But the point she was making was I had brought that pride into my marriage. It wasn't a result of living with an alcoholic. And she did that with every other defect on my list, and there were quite a few. I know people whom I love and whose program I respect who feel that one inventory is enough. I personally have a sponsor that makes me do one about every 5 years, not over my entire life, over those 5 years. I think you will be able to be guided on that as in every other area. And if it works as it does for me, I don't plan to fix it. It depends on the person and the circumstances. And for goodness sake, get help on this step too. We don't have to wait until we're doing the fifth step to call in the troops, you know. I'm a believer in getting help with the inventory. I needed the people from whom I could hear the truth in love, who could help me remember what to put down. And the fifth one, which goes with it, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Self-knowledge alone isn't enough. We have to do something with it. And we confess to ourselves for insight and for knowledge, and we confess to God for forgiveness, which He does. I was told early on that if I ask God 1,000 times to forgive me, He doesn't hear me the last 999, because He did it the first time I asked. But we confess to other people for humility and for healing. This too is scripturally based. I grew up in a Southern Baptist church and I memorized lots of scripture. And I am glad. I've enjoyed knowing that. But I remember the particular one. And Sam Shoemaker, who, as I understand it, was the spiritual advisor for Bill Wilson, is said to have been responsible for this part of it. The scripture is, confess your sins one to another that you may be healed. And so we have good precedent set for admitting our wrongs to someone else. If someone else knows who we really are and loves us anyway, then I think we can love ourselves and we can believe that God does. Choose the right person with whom to do a fifth step. We used to have a wonderful AA in West Texas who swears that he paid an illegal alien $5 who didn't speak English to listen to his. I don't think that will work. I believe this is a very mutual thing. We share a fifth step. We both talk. Here again, if I've been there, I can say I know how you feel. If I haven't, I can say I've run across this before. Usually the person will be your sponsor, but not always. My sponsor would not listen to mine. She said, I love you too much and I'll be too easy on you. And she's the one who sent me to Marcy, and I did two with Marcy, and I have done one with my current sponsor, Donna Lancaster. And you know what? There is no original sin. It has all been done and done and done. In the movie Coal Miner's Daughter, there's that wonderful line when they're coming out of the motel, and she is so upset. And he says, well, hell, we didn't invent nothing. Just love it. And I tend to tell people who are worried about a fifth step, you haven't invented anything. I promise you, it's all been done and done and done. The value for me in hearing someone's fifth step is how much I learn about myself. I particularly learn what my values are. And I am reminded of the fact that I tend to be extremely judgmental. I think I am well enough today that the person telling me his fifth step isn't aware of that. But I have listened, for instance, to incest and embezzlement and one accessory to murder and didn't flicker a muscle. But the woman that told me she cheated her way through school nearly got thrown out of my house. I was enraged. I wanted to come up out of that chair fighting. And I thought to myself, what does this tell me about me? It still remains the one hardest thing I've ever had to handle in anyone's fifth step. Our friend Lindy just got through with these two, and I asked him to share with you what they meant to him, what he did about them, what he learned from them. And I wanted to do it while we were at that place in the steps. Lindy?
Really wanted to ask, you know, if everybody in here has done their fourth step, but I knew that that's not the thing to do. Because it's a real hard step. Blanche told me when we first started out that that would be the only reason that I couldn't continue with her if I refused to do the fourth and fifth step. And so I knew what was ahead of me, you know, before I started. I think we covered that on the very first day. It was not one of the easiest things that I've ever done. I did it the way she requested. I set it out in 7-year increments. Some of it I could not remember. I did the best I could. I was not able to do it at home. It was so emotional to me. The only place I could do it was at her apartment with her there. And I would do it 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour at a time until I completed it. It took me 4 months. There would be times that I would be sitting at the table writing it. The memories would flood back, and I would curse and cry because it was upsetting, you know, to think about those things again. And I needed a safe place. I needed somebody that I knew cared. I don't even know that I knew I needed that, except that I couldn't do it anywhere else. And I asked her if I might use the time, you know, that we had in our weekly sponsor meetings. And certainly I used more than one day. It just so happened that when we started, it was during the summer, and Blanche was on summer vacation, as teachers are, and I had 3 weeks of sick leave that I had to use. And that's how we got to where we were so close and were able to work on this. Mike asked me a while ago, whenever we were in the middle of this and everybody was coming up to talk, he said, was there anything that you didn't feel like that you could share or talk to your sponsor about? And there is absolutely nothing. She knows more about me than even my mother knows. My mother knows quite a bit, but there are some things that you keep from your mother, you know, so that she just doesn't get hurt real bad, you know. And I had to cover everything. You got to have somebody. I wasn't bizarre with her, I was just truthful. And I guess it surprised me more than anybody else that she just took it, and she never one time criticized me. Let me know several times, though, that there was a lot of things that I did that were not in my own best interest. As I say, it took me 4 months to complete this. I don't know how many pages of it there were. And that's not trying to make mine any bigger than anybody else. It just takes a lot of time. When you really want to sit down and go over your life, but I'm not any spring chicken either, you know. I've had a few years in there that I had to write down. And it was worthwhile. When I got to the end of that, when I was coming down close to the end, I was ready to be through. You know, Mike talked to me about another thing a while ago, too. He said, I get to thinking of other things, you know. Well, you can't be a perfectionist about this either. You've got to do the very best you can at it. Or I felt that I did the very best I could. And when I came to the end of that and I was through, I was ready to quit. And I let her know that we needed to set a time for that. I think we waited about 2 weeks. We set aside a Saturday to do the fifth step. It took 8 hours to go over this. Surprisingly enough, though, at the end of this, I had an equal amount of assets as well as defects. And when I started into that, I only had one asset that I could really tell her about. I thought that I was a punctual person, that's it. You know, I had, my self-image was so low, you know, that I didn't believe that I had, that I deserved to live. And she would point these out to me and let me know and show me where the assets were, also where the defects of character were and what I have to work with. Whenever I'm going through my morning first three steps, in fact, I go through the steps all the way up to where I am right now. And when I get to those, I turn those defects of character over to God for Him to remove from me and name them one by one. But I also claim the assets. They may not be as prevalent in my life, or maybe I don't recognize them as well as I do the defects, because I seem to have had a negative nature for the biggest part of my life. But at the end of that fifth step, I tore that stuff into a million pieces, threw it in the garbage, and to me, that's over. I don't have to go back over that anymore. As far as I'm concerned, it is water under the bridge, and I don't have to pay any prices for it anymore. I don't cover it with her anymore either. We've gone on to other things. I hope that you will see how much can be gained by doing these things. I don't want this to sound like a judgmental thing when I say it, but I have been in or around a 12-step program for a long time. And you can tell when a person really hears and suddenly they realize that life is to be lived and that it is important. And they catch on and they want to do the steps and they want to change their life. And that's what I want for all of y'all. Because that's the payoff on the other side of that. You can let the past go. Never has to bother you again. You may learn some things from it, but you're not going to be weighed down with it.
As I listen to a fifth step, I listen to the areas where a person does talk about things that perhaps it would be to his benefit if God removed. I don't even like to use the word defects, but I do get a piece of paper as I listen, and I draw a line down the middle, and on the upper left I put, "We will ask God to remove." Well, for instance, fear. That's not a defect of character, but I like God to remove it from my life. And as the person is talking, I act like a secretary. I just take notes of what I hear him saying. And the right-hand side, our assets, our strengths. Our Al-Anon literature tells us we must include those too. They are the raw material from which we will build our new life. And then I urge the people that I work with to go over each of the things on the left-hand side, the defects, and say two things. One, why did I hang on to this? Usually you see it was a defense thing that worked for us. I had temper tantrums. I yelled and screamed and threw things. Well into the program, 3 or 4 years into it. And I know what the payoff was. It was colorful, it was dramatic, and people walked on eggshells for a little while after that. Another one of mine is the inability or unwillingness to forgive. I know the payoff for that. Once I forgive you, you can hurt me again. Okay? I am vulnerable again. And as long as I stay mad at you, you can't hurt me. And then I have them ask a second question about each of those. How has it become a problem for me? Because if it hasn't, I don't believe we'll be willing for God to remove it. And I find this to be very useful. When I'm hearing the fifth step, I'm also taking one. And I find so many of the defects the same. And it's a matter of degree and willingness to have them removed. Which brings us to six. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. This was the hardest step for me. Everyone has one that was the hardest. This was my hardest one. It kept me from taking the fourth and fifth for a long time because I have defects that I enjoy a great deal. I have had to say, how has this become a problem to me? Or I'm not willing to give it up. You know, courage costs a lot more than caution. But no risk, no reward, right? And a new life is a threat as well as a promise. Because it's extremely difficult to make a 180-degree turn in ourselves. And this required for a total surrender again. And there were those two sticky words in it, entirely and all. I could have become somewhat ready to have him remove a few of them. But that's not the way it was written, and they never let me rewrite them. Lindy made the point that God has to remove them, not us. We have to supply the willingness, and I have had to pray for the willingness many times. And sometimes I've had to pray to be willing, you know, to be willing. I think we miss them because they fill some sick needs for us. And that's why we had a hard time letting go of them. But I know that when I supply the willingness, God supplies the power. 7 says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. This is, we are told, the humility step. There's a tremendous difference in humility and humiliation. I think humiliation is a debasing and a degrading thing and has no place in our lives at all. Humility is the sense of proportion between me and my higher power, and it is remembering which one of us is which. It is acknowledging my creaturehood, and it is the feeling I get when so many marvelous things happen. During the worst of the drinking years, I used to back God in a corner and shake my finger in his face and say, why me? You know, why not me, after all? And there have been so many times since I've been with you all that things have been so beautiful and the reward so great that in a totally different context, you know, I can look at God and say, why me? What in the world have I done to deserve all these good things? Humility is what I feel when people stand after a talk at a convention, or humility is what I feel when I get those letters that I told you about. And I think, oh my goodness. And then I have to remember that I don't have to be the source, I only have to be the channel. And if I can get myself out of the way long enough, you know, sometimes God can use me, or you, or any of us. I'm a great believer in being responsible for what we say. If I am ever angry with you, and I say some unpleasant things, which I certainly hope never happens, I will mean every word of it. I don't say things I don't mean. When I'm angry, I just say things I wouldn't ordinarily say. And I think people are responsible for the words that they use. I used to talk to my English classes about this, and I would say, words have tremendous power. They agree with that. They have the power to heal, the power to hurt. And they understood that being responsible for what you say. They always thought it meant using the right word at the right time, and choosing your wording and your timing carefully. But if I said, you're also responsible for what you don't say, I usually got blank stares. How could you be responsible for something you didn't do? But with enough questioning, you know, you can word it so that you get the right answer, they usually realize that, yes, we are responsible for the apology not made, the support not given, the encouragement, the praise not expressed, the sympathy not verbalized. And those are shortcomings. That's when we come short. I did not have in my past, and I bet you didn't, a lot of red, raw social sins. But I had a number of areas where I had omitted pen the word shortcomings to be any different from defect. He just meant it as a synonym. I'm glad I didn't know that the first time around, because I very much needed some explanation of having come short. And so with humility being a sense of proportion, I began to learn some differences. One of them was the difference between pride and gratitude. I had taken pride in a great many things. I was proud of a great many things, and I always took credit for them. And in every area where I have taken pride, I have been rather severely humbled, not humiliated, humbled. And so I have learned now when people say nice things such as, well, I do have two really neat kids. I'm sure your kids are too. I'll give you equal time after the meeting and I will listen while you talk about them. But when people say nice things about them, years ago I learned to say, thank you, I'm very grateful for them. Not proud of them. Because I have sense enough to know that I didn't do it. My son is a commercial photographer in Dallas, and he has won two Clios. That's the highest award you can get in advertising, and he's the only photographer in the country ever to have won two of them. He was the first one out of New York to win one. The Dallas trade journals and business papers made a big issue over it, and they never once said after his name, comma, son of. I do not take credit for his talent. I know who provides talent, and it is not I. So I'm very grateful for him. My daughter is making what seems to me a great deal of money. It's easily twice what I make, which wouldn't be hard. She is an assistant managing editor of a bureau that the St. Petersburg Times maintains. She's the journalist. She's the first female to have ever held this job. And she too has remarkable talent. We are achievers. We are doers in my family. What we can't seem to do is maintain intimate relationships, having grown up as we did in dysfunctional families. But we're learning and we're working on it. And I have tremendous gratitude for these. I found now that I hear the word pride almost as an obscenity. You know, it kind of scares me. I hear someone mention it and I go, as if it were a four-letter word, because you told me to be grateful instead. Number 8 says, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. For a great many people, steps 4 and 5 are the milestones, the turning point, the place at which they say my life was never again the same. But for me, it was 8 and 9. I have no explanation for that, except that I think a good inventory does turn up the names of people that we have harmed. And I personally, and I bet you too, do not hurt people on purpose. Knowingly, you know, I don't lie awake nights thinking, how can I make so-and-so miserable? I really don't. And so I needed some guidance in finding the names of these people. My sponsor suggested that I start with God, and I was appalled to think that I could in any way hurt God. She pointed out that the analogy of parent and child is used throughout the scriptures, and that the way our children can hurt us most is to shut us out of their lives. No argument with that. When my daughter was 8 years old, she knew just which button to push, and when she was mad at me, she would stomp that little foot and she would say, I'm never going to tell you anything about me again. And if she'd ever been able to stick with that, it would have broken my heart. And I had indeed shut him out of my life. Then I was told to put myself second because I had done myself incredible damage. If anyone else had treated me the way I treated me, I would have been enraged. I have a friend in the program who says that he tries to be his own best friend. That if a friend came over for dinner, he would not hand him an open can of ravioli and a plastic fork and say, you stand over the sink so you don't make a mess and eat. But he does that to himself. And he's trying to learn to treat himself at least as well as he would a friend. I have a very hard time ever being ill. I feel guilty. And I am usually healthy, thank you. But I do have occasional and severe migraines. My grandmother used to say when I was ill, he maketh me to lie down. It may be the only time I give myself permission. I do not think, by the way, that God sends illness, okay? But my point is, if you were sick, I would give you permission to lie down. And it's very hard to give myself permission. So I'm trying to treat myself at least as well as I do my friends. And those were the first two on my list. And then followed, of course, my husband and my children, and I went on from there. She had a paper with 3 columns. And I put the name of the person in the first column, what, in what way I had harmed the person in the second, and what form the amends should take in the third. That isn't in our literature, that's just something that works. You may have something else that works fine. But what I realized from doing this is that amends do come in different forms. Some of the people required only an apology from me, but in some cases, like our children, you know, I'll be making amends the rest of my life. I will be leading, I hope, an amended life. I had not just overt acts, as I said, but I had tremendous neglect in some areas, and I had to make amends for what was my responsibility and had not been done. By the way, making the amends, which leads us into step 9, I was told that the reaction of other people was not my problem. I was glad I knew that ahead of time, because when I began doing this, I wasn't greeted every time with, "Oh, that's all right. I behaved pretty badly myself." Every now and then I got, "Well, you ought to be sorry," or worse. Step 9 says, "May direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others." When I was a little girl living in Florida, I grew up there. We were fourth generation Floridians. We were not tourists. Tourist was a bad word. Anytime I behaved inappropriately, my mother would say, "Don't act like a tourist." It was hot and humid, and this was before the time when homes were air-conditioned. And I remember learning to make pie crust. And I had then the temper that I have mentioned, and I would roll it out, and it would be like chewing gum. And I was enraged, and I would throw down the rolling pin and throw down the pie crust, and she would say, "Roll it out again. Be thankful if you can do it over," she said. "There will be hundreds of times in your life when you give anything on earth for the chance to do something over, and you won't have it. Always be thankful if you can do it over." Well, we can't do it over, but in step 9, we can at least try to make it right. And that's the next best thing. And notice that the amends have to be direct. I can't tell you to tell someone else for me, but I have to do the contacting myself. It required for me the help of my sponsor, and even now it does, to know exactly when I do owe amends to someone. And this is a matter of what works for you, too. I don't make amends for thoughts. The reason I don't is that through these 23 years, more people than I can count have come up to me and said, "I need to make amends to you. You don't know how I hated you and resented you." And I thought, and I didn't need to know either. You know? And I felt that I was a dumping ground for someone else's guilt. And I have not made amends for thoughts, although I think they are very powerful. I think the timing is important, the when and the where, and the wording is important. Because I am a communicator, I seem to be able, one of the areas in which I am asked to help a great deal is in choosing words. Everyone from the principal of my school to one of the young men I sponsor this week called and said, "Now, I've got to say this. How should I say it?" The young man breaking up with a girlfriend and not wanting to hurt her feelings. How can you say that without hurting? The husband of one woman I sponsor said that when they are arguing, she pulls a script out and reads from it. Not exactly, but I have suggested a phrase or two that I think might work better than what she had been saying. She had been using a great many obscenities, and I thought maybe that sounded a little harsh and aggressive. So the timing is important, and the words are important, and you can get some help on that if you need it. The hardest part of making amends for me is knowing that I have to make amends even for a bad reaction. I see I'm responsible for my reaction. And no matter how justified it might be, I am responsible for having had a bad reaction. And I don't like making those amends, but I do it rather than carry it around. The last three steps are maintenance steps. And 10 says, continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I like the fact that it says when and not if, because we will be wrong. The first year I ever taught school, back before the earth cooled, a long time ago, at the end of the day, my principal had taught us to have a short evaluation. What did we do today that you liked? What did we do that didn't work so well? When I switched to high school teaching, I would do it at the end of a unit of study or at the end of a semester. And some of the best ideas I got from students who would say things like, 4 weeks is really too long to spend on the Scarlet Letter. We got kind of burned out on it before we got through. Or why didn't we spend longer on short stories? And I could do that. I could rearrange it. So I knew about evaluating. And so it was a very natural thing then to start looking over my day and saying, what went right? You know, what did I do right? And giving myself a little gold star for those. I can share those little victories now. Those that, you know, we have that no one ever sees or knows about. And then I can look at things that didn't turn out so well, and I no longer castigate myself and wallow in remorse and guilt. But I'm able to say, that wasn't in my best interest. That was not productive. That didn't work out too well. Or I believe I won't do that again. Most of the time. There are times still when I am devastated when it's not perfect. Last year was my first year counseling in the public schools, and when my principal did an evaluation, I did not get outstanding in everything. I got satisfactory in two things. And I was 10 years old again, and I had not made 100. And I told everyone who would listen, can you believe what happened to me? So most of the time, I can say that wasn't in my best interest. There are times still when I absolutely have to do it right. I don't have to be right, but I have a great deal of self-esteem invested in doing things well. I know it could be worse, but I'd rather not have that much of a hindrance in my life. I do a mental inventory during my 11th step time, and I don't miss many days on that, as I'm sure you don't either. I only write it down occasionally, and the reason I write down step 10 occasionally is that I keep a journal, so it's easy for me. I don't know what I would do if I were not writing by nature. I don't know how I feel or what I think until I write it down. I write down everything. And so for me, this works very well. Another word in this step that bothers me is personal inventory, which means I'm not allowed to take yours, only mine. And, you know, I used to think that all of this introspection would make me self-centered. I would become a moral hypochondriac, you know, looking for every little flaw. But it doesn't work that way. It works like driving a car down the highway and suddenly you hear a knock or a miss in the motor and you realize that at some level you were listening, but you weren't hunting it. And with continuing recovery, I am more sensitive to the knocks in the motor, but I do not spend my day thinking about what did I do wrong. Does that make sense? Sometimes when I talk to a group, I feel as if I'm teaching a lesson on subordinate clauses, you know? Yeah, I say it over, so not at me or something. In fact, it's the only way to be free of self, rather than being self-centered. When it came to admitting that we were wrong, we had two fallacies at my house. I truly am sorry when I hurt someone, and it is not difficult at all for me to say so. In fact, I'm pretty miserable until I can make it right. I do not like strained relationships. I value relationships, and I invest a great deal in them. And so my husband at that time thought that anyone who could say it that easily couldn't possibly mean it. He, on the other hand, was incapable of saying it in any way at all, and I assumed if you couldn't say it, you never felt it. And we had been with you an awfully long time before we were able to talk that through and reach the conclusion that those were myths, both of them. There are a number of things I say easily. I love you is one of them, that I mean with all my heart. I don't ever say it if I don't mean it. Nor do I, by the way, say I was wrong if I wasn't. I used to do that, you know, as I told you earlier, I apologize for everything that happened anywhere. Gail and I were talking this morning about the weather, and she was laughing and saying she no longer feels responsible for it. I used to, too. I've quit apologizing for things like that. Number 11, thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. We could have a whole hour's program and more on this because whole books have been written on both these subjects. I can just tell you briefly that this is hard spiritual work. I have been praying all my life, but my prayers consisted sort of multiple choice lists that I gave to God, or a script I had written and I wanted his official okay on it, giving him instructions again. And the word salt implies that we have to dig this out. And the tools handed us are the prayer and the meditation. This became very real to me when I'd been with you for about 4 years, and I got so busy that I was frantic. I tend to do this. I use busyness like a narcotic. Do any of you do that? If you don't slow down, you won't have to think or feel. And I happened to mention to my husband's sponsor, from whom I learned as much as I did my own, that I was so frantically busy, and she said, "You're not giving enough time to the 11th step." And I said, "You didn't understand me. I'm so busy now, I don't know what I'm going to do." And she said, "You should seek the giver rather than the gift." And she said, I remember these two sentences, she said a lot more. But she also said, 5 minutes a day may be time enough for contact, but it's not time enough for growth. And so when I get frantically busy now, I try to remember more time for prayer and meditation. And all the non-essentials fall away. All the trivia. And I can't tell you how it happens, I only know that it does. And I don't spend hours in meditation and I don't chant, although I have respect for the people who do. That's what works for them. But it takes me 20 or 30 minutes. And the days I miss it, I can tell it. I do some things that work for me, and here again, this is my experience. I have a little prayer notebook. I was taught long ago that the four components of prayer were praise and thanksgiving, confession, intercession, and petition. And I have a page for each of those. I have a list of things that I thank God for on a daily basis, and I add things. And I have a page with a blank in it for confession and for asking forgiveness, because there are different things at different times. And I have a long list of people for whom I pray the intercession. But I have a short list on my refrigerator door, which I obviously see more often than I do my prayer notebook. And there are people who, knowing that that's where my intensive prayer list is, have called me and said, "Would you put my name on your refrigerator door?" It embarrassed my daughter for years that her name was up there for everyone to see. And so for many years, I wrote it in shorthand. She isn't home that often now, so I have it written in regular handwriting. And I do pray for others. I do not tell God anymore what to do with and for them. I pray that they find and do the will of God. I believe I am entitled to ask that of him, and I do. We used to have rousing discussions in my group in West Texas when we came to this step in our step study about praying only for knowledge of God's will for us or praying for specifics. There were people who prayed for parking places and about the cake in the oven, you know, and there were those who only asked to know the will of God. And I guess I fall somewhere in between, but I used to feel that if we could pray for our daily bread, that's pretty specific, you know, give us this day our daily bread. If we could pray for physical needs to be met, which is what that implies, then I think I can pray about anything that concerns me, and I do. And here again, this is what works for me. And how do we know his will? That's a good program topic, too, by the way. I'll tell you this, and I've told you all I know about the Quakers, but one of their beliefs, as I understand it, is that God gives everyone a certain number of responsibilities, and those make up his bundle, and you must not assume someone else's bundle. If you do, you deny him an opportunity for growth. he is prevented from learning what he would have learned in that situation if we had not rushed in and taken it over. So I know now that not everything is my assignment. Just because I'm aware of a need does not mean that it's the will of God that I do it or that I fill it. And I have told you that I believe that I will be given the desire to do it and the ability and the time and the energy. And that's the yardstick by which I measure, knowing His will for me. I also believe that I am expected to know my limitations. I do not have to ask God whether it's His will that I audition for the Metropolitan Opera. I know it is not. I do not have that ability. I'm aware of those limitations, and I'm aware that there are other things that I can do, and someone else can do that. People ask me sometimes, what do you do when you get the spiritual blahs and you don't feel like praying? I have heard, here again, people whose program I really respect say that they just take time off for a while. That maybe like cotton crops that needs a dry spell. I can't do that. I have to go ahead and go through the motions. And if I'm not having spiritual goose pimples at that point in time, it doesn't matter. I sometimes believe with an AA friend in Winnipeg that the program is like castor oil. It works whether I believe in it or not. And so for me, I go ahead and I do the praying and I work at the meditating, whether I'm feeling deeply spiritual or not. I think that I'm doing pretty well to know His will for me. And I don't presume to know it for anyone else anymore. I used to think that I did. I'm not very good at meditating. Up until now, I have not been very good at meditating. I have done some practice on that during the past year. I do not achieve an altered state of consciousness, but I am increasingly able to shut down my mind and to just feel. And when I can do that, the most astonishing things float to the surface. And I can't do it every time I try, but I'm better. I also do a lot of writing during my 11th step time. I write in my prayer notebook and I write down the things that come to me during meditation. I happen to do this in the late afternoon. As I told you, I don't wake up doing this. I think it comes from all those years of coming in from school and sort of catching my breath, you know, and getting my second wind. Anyway, that's when it works best for me. And when I don't think I want to do His will, I have to ask what kind of God I believe in, and certainly not one that would hurt me or whose will would be harmful to me. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The spiritual awakening is promised only as the result of these steps. That was another program topic we used to have in my original group. We would say, tell us what form your spiritual awakening took. Mine was awareness. That's not an unmixed blessing, because as I became more aware of the beautiful and the wonderful things, I became more aware of the painful ones too. But I wouldn't go back, because that would be like having been blind and now I could see. I would not wish to be blind again. Most of us do not have blinding lights and visions or hear voices. I have a priest friend who says that just getting his head back on was his spiritual awakening. And Chuck C. out in California used to say being able to eat his breakfast was a spiritual awakening for him. It's an individual matter. But I'm grateful for my awareness and I pray for more. This step is in three parts, and the second one says that we carry the message. And there are many, many ways to do this. One is just by being present. By sitting in that chair this afternoon, you're saying to me, this is important to me. And if you've been around a long time, as I have, when I do that, I'm saying, this is still important to me. That there is no graduation, as you told me at the beginning, not even any recess, a few coffee breaks along the way. I had to learn to use the telephone. I know that most people think women are born talking on the phone. I always thought the phone was good for making appointments to see people. And I much prefer, you know, the eyeball-to-eyeball contact. But our literature talks about telephone therapy. I have a friend in Virginia, in Al-Anon, who calls this aspirin Al-Anon. And I do very well on the phone now. I still prefer the person's presence, but for many years now I have been able to do my share, I think, of message carrying by phone. And if it is your assignment to share in groups, then that's what you will want to do. And if you do more one-on-one work, then that's what you're supposed to do. We are carrying the message and not the people. And that's where our teaching of detachment comes in, but that's another whole program. And then we're told to practice these principles. You know, the principles are these rules for victorious living that we have been given in the program. And we practice them in all of our affairs. This presupposes, I think, that we will have the normal activities of normal people. I go to one meeting a week now, most weeks, sometimes two, and I make a convention one weekend a month, most months. But I'm not a program junkie. And I know people who are, and I sometimes think perhaps they substitute meetings for doing. That's a judgment, and I don't know that. But I do know that in our Blueprint for Progress, we are strongly urged to be active citizens of our community, and that we have other things going on in our lives. We practice them in all our affairs, whatever yours might be. Don C. up in Massachusetts says, Al-Anon is not my whole life, but it makes my life whole. So I think I go into these other activities with better tools for coping than people who have no program and no way of life. And I mustn't forget where I got it. And that has to stay first, because without it I wouldn't have the others. The two places hardest to practice the principles for me were in my own group and at home. Now in Austin this isn't such a problem because I haven't been able to stay with one group that long. At first when I was in graduate school, it depended on my schedule. And it depends now on when I'm working. In the summer I go to daytime groups, and in the winter I have to go on Saturdays or at night. So not any one group knows me the way my original one did. They used to think they knew me when I could barely find the door to the building. And so they were singularly dedicated to keeping me humble. And I think it's very hard to practice the principles with the people that we love most and with whom we are the closest. We were our sickest at home with these people. And I think we tend to react in the same old way to the same old stimulus. One definition of growth is a new reaction to an old stimulus. We tend not to let each other change. I mentioned Chuck C. He said something else that I liked a whole lot. He said, the more we know and the less we do, the deeper the depression. Knowing, reading, hearing about the steps won't do it. It requires the action and the doing. And once we are informed of a better way of life and we choose to ignore it, I think we do so at our emotional peril.